stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 173 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from San Francisco, California. I am Andrew Brokus, joined in Somerville, Massachusetts by Nate Mavis.
How are you, Andrew?
Did I just dangle that preposition?
Joined
in Somerville, Massachusetts by Nate Mavis?
I think that works. Joined in Somerville, Massachusetts by Nate Mavis. I think that works.
I think it would be better joined by in Somerville, Massachusetts, Nate Mavis.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Somerville, Massachusetts, and by Nate Mavis are both, you know, perfectly legitimate clauses. Is that a clause? I think you can chain those up as you wish. But maybe I've been looking through too much Greek recently, where that would be totally unremarkable.
This is why we call it the Nickcast, people.
Yeah. Some things are important, but the weather here is good. I'm happy. I trust the weather out there is good also.
It has been particularly beautiful this week. I spent about an hour in the park today rereading applications of No Limit Hold'em. You're laughing at that.
Title makes me laugh, but it's a good book. I'm sure. We sometimes get the question whether somebody who only has time for one of these books, whether that person should read the Janda book or the Tipton book or Mathematics of Poker. Do you have a view on that question?
I'm inclined to say, especially for the question of whether to read Mathematics of Poker or one of the other two books, it kind of depends on who you are and what you're looking to get out of it. I mean, I think Mathematics of Poker, it is the most heavily theoretical of three very theoretical books, very theory-driven books. But unlike the other two, I mean, Tipton and Janda both make a concerted effort to apply game theory to actual No Limit Hold'em situations. And there's a lot less of that Mathematics of Poker, but there's a lot more kind of mathematical precision in Mathematics of Poker. And I do think that it's kind of good preparation for the other two to some extent to read that. But it's also, I think the math in there is going to be intimidating to a lot of people. I guess I'm starting to lean more towards recommending one of the other two. I kind of like applications because it's slightly less in depth than Expert Heads Up, and I think it gives a bit more practical advice than Expert Heads Up. I mean, I guess I would say Mathematics of Poker is kind of the most theoretical and requires you to do the most work in terms of figuring out exactly how it's going to affect your actual play in No Limit Hold'em or any other game. And I think Janda does the most of that work for you, and Tipton is somewhere in between. But really, if you like one of them, I don't see a lot of reason why you wouldn't read the other two. They're all good, and I don't think there's a tremendous amount of overlap between them.
You're making me feel bad for not having finished Janda's book. That has probably more to do with my personal emotional baggage than anything else. Good. That's a good, honest book recommendation. Also, it is poker season now, and I am super excited about poker, and I'm thinking about poker all the time, and it's just great. This is how, like, my world, you know, this is how, like, my year breaks into sections. Like, winter, I'm thinking about baseball a lot. Beginning of the baseball season, I'm thinking about baseball a lot. Then I'm thinking about baseball and snooker. Then, like, poker comes over me, and, a lot of poker, watching Carlos's Twitch stream, working with my students, working on my own game, making videos for TPE. It's a very exciting part of the year.
So what happens between the end of poker season and the beginning of baseball season?
Yeah, that's a good question. Detox? Chilling out? All sorts of other things.
Maybe your life comes to the forefront at some point?
Oh, no. That always comes, family always comes first. But as a matter of hobbies, there's the World Series, and then the World Series of Baseball after that. And then, there's usually some other stuff going on too. the weather gets nice around here in the fall. I take a lot of walks. Yeah, then I start worrying about baseball again during hot stove season. Also, fantasy baseball preparation season.
Now, speaking of family, I want to tell a quick story on here because we've talked a few times about teaching kids to play poker, kind of when kids are developing various skills related to poker. And I've mentioned a couple times on here my my cousin's kids. So apparently the middle one, who's almost seven now, but not quite, they play this game. I think it's called Love Letters, but it's kind of like Memory, I think, where there's like face down cards and you try to remember which ones are where and get matches. And so Oliver, the middle one, so not only did he like figure out that he could essentially, you know, detect marked cards, the cards are, you know, worn on the back in various ways, and he could figure out which cards were which based on the wear on the cards. But I think probably the more impressive thing is that he managed to not just like blurt that out or like make it obvious that that's what he was doing, but use that information to like beat his older brother enough times that the older brother like got suspicious and accused him of cheating, which is a safe assumption because Oliver cheats a lot. And so eventually it became clear what Oliver was doing. But I think that's kind of, I mean, I don't quite want to say proud because it's not like good to be cheating, but just impressive that he kind of had the wherewithal to pick up on that, to recognize how it could be used, and to keep it on the down low for a while.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm very impressed. That's a lot of cleverness. And, you know, a lot of kids cheat a little bit. I wouldn't encourage it, but your pride is not misplaced, I don't think. It's a great story. as I think I mentioned to you before, it's... can I stake this guy at the Borgata if they haven't changed the cards by then when he turns 21? They had a problem with that back in the day, like with the backs wearing off a little bit.
See, I'm embarrassed. I'm so oblivious to this stuff. I mean, I really, like, I've played at the Borgata a number of times, and like that didn't jump out at me as a problem. I didn't notice. I mean, there was all the hullabaloo about the cards at the WSOP last year, and, you know, I didn't notice the problem for myself. I mean, once other people, you know, mentioned it, I could kind of recognize it, but... I don't know, like how are you actively looking for those things when you play poker? Are you kind of wondering like how susceptible is this particular setup to cheats?
Yes, but over time it just becomes part of like how you perceive the situation. Like a dented card I find very noticeable if there's a nail mark in it. And I don't really know how I wouldn't notice these things. So like it's just sort of like how I see the situation, but I also try to look out for it. I thought we had a funny conversation last year when you said like I was playing with Mr. X and he was sort of handling his cards in a funny way, but he also wasn't really playing in the way that somebody who knew what cards I had would look. So like it sort of looks like he must have been marking the cards, but then it, you know, it didn't seem like it. And I said like, oh well, you know, where's fingernails trimmed? And you said, like, why would I look at, you know, like, as if that was the most...
I mean, when you asked the question, I understood why you were asking.
Yeah.
But it didn't occur to me to look at the time.
Yeah. I mean, you were surprised that I asked you and that I assumed that you would know what shape his fingernails were in. And then I felt silly for making that assumption very shortly thereafter. Yeah, it's just a live pro thing, I think. Although, yeah, after a while, it just... Especially like if you've spent even I think one session being paranoid about it, the way the light reflects off the back of the cards becomes very, very noticeable, and it's very hard not to see it after that, which is a good thing. I'm sure there's a lot of things you can look for that I don't look for, but I do try to see it. And I also, I don't know, also when I'm in the tank, at least in some sessions, I make a point of like looking straight down whether I'm bluffing or value betting, and you got to look at something while you're doing that. So you might as well look at the cards and the setup. So that's a long way of saying sort of, I guess. Also, Todd Brunson is tweeting at me and I'm excited about that.
That's a legit brag.
Yeah. Wait. By the way, are your books available in actual book form, like hardcover? Boom. Todd Brunson is
buying Thinking Tournament Poker.
Yeah. I'm tempted to offer to print them out and mail them to him. Is that weird or creepy?
No, I think that's reasonable for Todd a man of Todd Brenton's stature.
Yeah, okay, sounds good. It's right. Although, I don't know, he might think it's creepy, but I think it's a chance I should be willing to take.
I think people like being treated like VIPs.
Okay, okay. Can you say something smart for 20 seconds while I tweet that at him?
I'll give people the heads up that it's just going to be Nate and myself for this episode. We do not have a guest. We are going to be talking, as we do on this kind of show, more about strategy than we sometimes do on the show. We are going to talk about some specific hands, and we're also going to have a more broad strategy question coming up about just kind of how to practice or improve a poker in general. So that's what to look forward to this episode. And if you only listen to the show for the guests and find Nate and me detestable, then we'll see you in episode 174.
Exactly. And if you don't like real-time Twitter updates from several days ago now, sorry. I've tweeted at Todd. This is all very exciting. Like most poker players, you're probably trying to nail down that perfect schedule for this year's World Series of Poker. Don't waste time hunting down schedules and spreadsheets or relying on social media when you have all that information right at your fingertips with Shark Clock. Starting this summer, Shark Clock is here to help you plan the best summer poker trip for your bankroll by easily finding the events you want to play and letting you save them on your iPhone or Android device. No ads and no login required. Download Shark Clock in the App Store, Google Play, or sharkclock.com.
Our first strategy question is coming to us from Sam. Sam says, I am a middle-aged male with a good day job, and I am very interested in poker. I've read dozens of well-known poker books, including many that you recommend. I listen to several poker podcasts, such as Thinking Poker, and so I have a general idea of how the poker world works. I occasionally, but not frequently, play 1-2 No Limit at my local casinos. I would consider my sample size small, but my results are essentially neutral. I frequently make mistakes, but the frustrating thing is that I often recognize my mistake the moment my chips are in the pot or not too long after my session. In other words, after it is too late. I have built a bankroll playing blackjack at an advantage. I'm a very proficient card counter. I generally feel the hourly rate achievable in blackjack is better than in poker with the same bankroll, but I feel poker is more sustainable. Besides that, I find poker very engaging. One of the upsides of card counting is that it can mostly be learned away from the table using rote exercises. I learn very well this way. I have found that with poker, more needs to be learned at the table than away from the table, which can get expensive. I've also struggled to find rote exercises that I can do away from the table. I have a registered copy of Flopzilla and a variety of books, but have not been able to come up with rote exercises to practice and sharpen my poker skills. Can you suggest some exercises that I can do away from the table to improve my poker game? So I think there's kind of a lot going on here.
Exactly.
Start by answering his explicit question, unless you have, is there anything you want to say before that?
So can I just say, I think it's awesome that he beats blackjack, and it sounds legit. Maybe he's self-deceived, but this seems like what somebody who actually beats blackjack would say. So kudos to you for building a bankroll playing blackjack. I don't know a lot about blackjack, but I do think that... although the hourly rate might be better in blackjack than in poker, although if you play well enough, you can play high enough stakes where that might not be true anymore. Maybe you will enjoy having an edge that's bigger than 0.25%. Maybe you'll like that, or 1%, or maybe 2%. So that does happen sometimes in poker, and it feels pretty good. So you got that to look forward to. Yeah. So with my students, this is something I do actually. One thing that I spend some time thinking about is exercises for them. Not necessarily rote exercises, but specifically things that they can drill a little bit, or at least work through a few problems about to make them better. So I can say some of the things, like, without knowing exactly Sam's frame of mind and how he plays. I can recommend a few things. A first exercise is not something that would actually make him know more about the tactics, but it sounds like he would improve at poker if he just took a deep breath before he made every action or, you know, paused a beat. Like, there are sometimes when you'll make a play and then you'll immediately realize that it's wrong. And why not just wait the 2 seconds before you make the play so that you can correct it before you do it? But that's not really like a poker tactics exercise. I do think that first counting combinations in various ranges, that can be really useful. So say, oh, I would 3-bet aces through queens and ace king. How many combinations is that? And that's like a pretty simple exercise. It's 16 plus 18 or 18, 20, 34. But then, you know, you add more and it gets a little bit harder. And just being able to do that a little bit quicker really speeds up your estimations over the table. And it gives you some sense that ace king through ace six is a whole lot of combinations. So that's one thing you can do. Another thing you can do is just say things like, what hand is about 50-50 against a top 20% range? What hand is about 50-50 against a top 30% range? What hand is about 33% against a top 33% range? And you don't have to be exact, and it's not to answer trivia questions exactly, but these spots just come up over and over and over again, especially if you're playing tournaments or especially if you're playing in games where there are some short stack situations. Just having a sense of, so like, for example, something people say a lot is, I don't know what to do when I have ace king and I miss the flop. And I think one reason they're confused is because they don't know how well ace king does against certain ranges on certain flops. And doing this kind of exercise can really help you figure out like how likely your opponent is to have a pair and do that. I think that's not very popular. I'm not sure a lot of coaches do that, but it's something that I've done personally that I think helps. And I also think if you want a rote drill, you can do a lot worse than that. I don't know. What do you think of all that?
There was one other thing. This is actually something that Sam sent in a follow-up email. When I told him that we were going to discuss this on the show, he said, I certainly understand that a winning poker game cannot rely on rote strategy, but to the extent that some things can and should be known by heart, I would like to know what those things are and how best to learn them. And I do want to say, because he has a background in blackjack, and I also don't know a lot about playing advantage blackjack, but I don't think that you're really going to learn poker in the same way. It's not going to be about when I get these cards, I do this. There's just a lot more other than just, you know, the count in blackjack, you know, knowing how many tens are left in the deck or whatever. There's a lot more situational factors, even as early as preflop, that will have an effect. I mean, to some extent, I guess, like preflop ranges are the closest you could get to kind of like rote strategy and no limit. But even then, you know, stuff like positions and stack sizes and things have an influence on that. And you know, who's behind you can have an influence. But certainly once we get into post-flop play, there's not a lot of, it's not just kind of memorizing, here's what I do in this situation. I think a lot more of it is kind of about understanding sound poker strategy at a theoretical level, which doesn't have to be as complicated as you know, mastering mathematics of poker or mastering the other books that we discussed earlier in the show. But I do think that you just kind of understanding broadly what kinds of hands tend to benefit from aggression and which kinds of hands tend not to benefit from aggression, and the things that you mentioned, just kind of recognizing when you have a strong hand and when you don't, based on the ranges people are likely to be playing and you know, where a hand sits in your own range. I think stuff like that is, I wouldn't exactly call it rote, but that's the kind of thing that I think a lot of people would do well to understand better.
I agree. But I do think, so I completely agree that thinking that poker is just something that you can memorize spot by spot. I mean, that's how people tried to learn it on the forums in 2004 sometimes, and it didn't turn out well for them most of the time. I completely agree. I don't think you would disagree with this, but we all bring our own skills to poker, and this person has muscles that I don't have and has capacities that I don't have if he can be an advantage blackjack player. So he's probably capable of keeping track of a lot of information in real time and sort of applying a memorized strategy very quickly. So as long as he doesn't make the mistake of thinking that poker can just be learned spot by spot mechanically, I think he should absolutely use the muscles that he has that most poker players don't have.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. So good luck. Do you have any other ideas for drills that are better?
I was going to make some suggestions for how he can study the things that that I think are important. And one, in Ed Miller's Poker's 1%, which we didn't mention when we were discussing the game theory books, but I often recommend that as kind of an introduction for people who really don't even understand like what game theory is or why they should bother with it. I think Ed does a better job of explaining it, although, you know, and he'll be the first to admit it's a less mathematically precise book than the other ones that we discussed. But I think that he does more to kind of offer like a common sense, plain language explanation of why you should care about this stuff. And you know, he kind of talks in the book about what your betting frequency should look like in certain situations and what your calling frequency should look like in certain situations. And he even suggests some exercises that you can do in terms of saying, well, if I raise preflop and get called out of the blinds, I'm going to bet approximately 70% of my hands on the flop. And if I do that and get called, I'm going to bet approximately 70% of the hands that I bet on the flop on the turn, and then if I get called again, I'll bet approximately 70% of those hands from the turn on the river. I think that you could do worse than just kind of breaking down your own range a little bit. And you know, I mentioned one of the important things is to have a sense of where a certain hand sits in your own range. So looking at that and saying, okay, this is a hand that's good enough to bet again, this isn't, or this is a hand that's good enough to call again versus this is a hand that belongs in my folding range. And this is something that you really have to do away from the table. You want to build the intuition so that you can make good guesses about where a hand sits in your range while you're actually playing, but you're not going to be able, or I mean, maybe he can, maybe this is one of the muscles he'll have, but I personally am not able to like visualize my entire range, including, you know, an exact count of how many combinations of each hand are going to be in it. So it's more just a matter of building an intuition and learning some heuristics for recognizing which bucket a certain hand should go into. But I think taking notes on particular spots that seem to be giving you trouble and then trying to look at those in a theoretical way away from the table and say, you know, what's my range going to be in this spot? And you know, what are the strongest hands I could have or the weakest hands I could have? And also maybe doing some kind of expected value calculations. And if you're looking, for instance, at a bluff, saying to yourself, how often do I need this player to fold considering what my equity is when he calls? And you know, is it realistic to think that he will fold those hands? What are the hands he will and won't fold? Or if you're calling a bet, you know, how much equity do I need to call and what kinds of hands do I think that he is betting? To some extent, you know, what's my plan for the next street? How many cards are good for me and how good are they? I think that just kind of analyzing some situations, not just in terms of what should I have done with these two cards that I have, but really trying to look at the at the expected value, like kind of using that to test your assumptions about what you think is profitable or what your friends are telling you is profitable, and also trying to approach it from a range analysis, like not just how am I going to play this hand, but what would my calling range be in this situation, what would my folding range be, what would my raising range be, and looking for imbalances.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And just to sort of amplify and maybe slightly precisify something you said, like one concrete drill might be take a board like Queen 7-6 with a flush draw and pretend that you're betting all in for a pot size bet on the flop and say, if I have a flush draw and an overcard, how much do I need him to fold to make this, you know, profitable relative to some other play? What if I have a gut shot? What if I have an open-ended straight draw? What if I have you know, bottom pair, you know, suppose, yeah. And seeing how your answer changes, as you vary the strength of your hand, I think would be very useful.
Yeah, I think that's a good point too. So thanks for writing, Sam. Hopefully, you found that to be of some use and hopefully some other people as well. Some other people will as well. One of the best ways to improve your tournament game away from the table is with a subscription to Tournament Poker Edge. There you can watch how dozens of successful players, including Nate and me, conquer a wide variety of tournaments from micro stakes to mid stakes to the main events of the World Championship of Online Poker and the World Series of Poker. You're bound to come away with lots of new moves and some leaks to plug, so sign up today at tournamentpokeredge.com. You want to read our second strategy hand?
Absolutely. Cyrus, who I like to imagine is the Cyrus from Turning Stone, but probably is not the Cyrus from Turning Stone, says, main villain in the hand seems to be one of the best at the table, though I can't be sure because he's been running very well. He's in his mid-20s and has been fairly active so far, but not recklessly so. Every time he's played a big pot and gotten called on the river, he's had the best hand. Not sure if it's relevant, but in an earlier hand, he raised an early position, got a few callers, I 3-bet from the blinds, he defended, and the rest folded. He called my flop bet on a jack-6-6 board, and folded to a turn bet on a brick card. I've been more tight, but when I played a hand, I've usually been the raiser. On to the hand. By the way, you know, thumbs up for this kind of opponent description. You know, it's not the most nuanced one you could have, but he seems to be trying, and understanding the limits of how well you can read your opponent is very important. So, full marks for that, Cyrus. 2-5 game at the Aria. I have a stack of about 1,400. Villain covers. Villain raises from under the gun plus 1 to 20, gets 2 callers. I have pocket aces in the big blind. I raise to 85. Villain calls, callers fold. I bet you have something to say about this.
Yeah, I want to raise bigger. Yeah. Especially being in the big blind. I think you're going to be pretty polarized when you're 3-betting here, meaning there's just not that many hands that you can profitably 3-bet at a position when you're this deep.
Yep.
And you are going to have a strong interest in winning the pot. Even with aces, like, winning the pot right away is really not the end of the world when you're this deep. And when your hand is going to be somewhat well-defined after 3-betting, like, playing a big pot at a position, as we're going to find here, is not that exciting of a prospect, even when you have aces, when you're this deep. So yep. I think, like, giving yourself a realistic chance of winning the pot pre-flop is something you're going to want to do with your range generally. And even the strongest hand in your range doesn't suffer that much from getting a few extra folds pre-flop. And certainly, you know, it also appreciates getting some more money into the pot pre-flop. And the shallower that you can make the effective stacks later, the easier it's going to be for you to play this hand. So I would want to 3-bet. We've got a raised 85 and 2 calls. I raised to 20 and 2 calls. I think I would want to make it at least 100, quite possibly 120.
Yep. Yeah, I would probably make it 105, but that's about right. Yeah, especially because if it's a typical 2-5 game, even if you raise big, something that will happen that's really good for you is that the villain will fold and one of the callers will make a bad call with whatever he's got sometimes. Like, well, look at all that money out there. And that's fine. That's fine. So, yeah, I would raise more. And I also think what you said about having a narrow raising range is important. One mistake that people who beat 2-5 games make that is a really terrible mistake is just sort of leaving their 3-betting module operative at all times, so to speak. Like, and when you're out of position 280 big blinds deep, is not the time you want to be 3-betting a lot, like, just for fun, unless your opponent is going to fold way too much on the flop or something. So, Cyrus continues, at this point, I think his range includes all pocket pairs, and though it's less likely, I'd include kings in that range. I'd also expect he defends ace-king, discounted because I have two of the aces. It's possible he also defends suited connectors, but I'm not sure given the size of the raise.
I'm pretty sure, given the size of the raise. This is one of the reasons I want to raise bigger. I mean, if I'm in the villain shoes, the only hands I'm really folding to the squeeze are going to be, like, very easily dominated hands that play badly in multi-way pots. So, I mean, the ace-queen offsuit, I'm going to fold, ace-jack offsuit. But, you know, suited aces I'm calling, suited connectors I'm calling, pocket pairs I'm calling. And I think it's profitable for me to call them when we're this deep and I have a good idea of what your range looks like and I'm in position. I mean, I would be very surprised if the villain is folding any suited connectors.
He really shouldn't. I think 2-5, maybe you haven't played 2-5 recently. I think some people just don't think those are $100 hands or $85 hands, and they fold. But most people who run up big stacks don't think that way. So there's
this villain, maybe I'm just reading too much into, like, mid-20s active but not reckless.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I have an image in my mind of a player who is not that unaware.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, yeah, and I do want to, like, amplify this. Like, his calling range should be and probably is very near his entire raising range, minus the stuff that's just absolutely terrible to play to a 3-bet, like ace-10 offsuit and so on. But, like, a suited semi-connector, if game conditions, which is not that likely, were such that I was raising jack-9 suited under the gun plus 1, I am not folding to this 3-bet.
Right. Yeah, you're getting 2-1 even if the other two players fold.
Yeah, and yeah, it's just too easy to for great things to happen. I mean, yeah. Okay. Good. So the pot is now about 205. The flop is, yeah. So once again, we have a raise to 20, two calls. Hero has re-raised to 85 out of the big blind. Under the gun, main villain calls, the callers fold. The hero has 280 big blinds, the villain covers. Pot is about 205. The flop is 3-4-5 rainbow. I decide to check for a few reasons. First, I'm out of position with large stacks in a big pot. This flop is not the best for my hand, though it's not the worst either, and if I get raised, I'm put in a difficult spot, since he can easily have hit a set. Second, hands like pocket sevens through tens and jacks might give me two straights of value, but I don't expect to get three anyway. Third, if he did call with an unpaired hand, checking can induce some bluffs if he assumes I just have ace-king or a similar hand. So I agree with this conclusion, but not quite with... I mean, what he says is good, but I would think about the situation slightly differently, but I should let you talk first, I think.
Yeah, I was going to give him props. I think this it's a good check, and it's a spot where I think a lot of people just kind of feel compelled for whatever reason to, you know, I raise pre-flop, so I have to bet the flop, or I'm going to look weak if I check, or I have an overpair, why wouldn't I bet? Or I have an overpair and a gotcha, why wouldn't I bet? So I think it's good that you're not just automatically continuation betting the flop. I would probably check here also. I think I didn't find a lot that I disagreed with in that paragraph, so I'm curious to hear what your you want to tweak.
So what I thought I said is that I agreed with what he said, but I would approach it a little bit differently and in some ways, maybe more in a more simple-minded way, and just say that, like, yeah, no, what he said was too good. I'm just going to make it easy on myself.
Dumb it down a little.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But look, we have a three-better and a caller. The three-better really shouldn't have threes, fours, fives, or 7-6 suited. The raised caller should have every single combination of threes, fours, fives, and 7-6 suited. So that's 9 + 4 equals the top 13 combinations are all in the caller's range and not in my range. Moreover, we are really, really, really deep. I think I would check my entire range here, actually. I think this is a good spot to check your whole range. If you want to try to win the pot with ace king, there's a reason, there's a way to do that, but you can probably find a spot to bluff with that hand later. And I probably, against a sufficiently good player, would not bet any hands here, just because this flop is a lot better for him than it is for me, and we're very deep. And if he knows how to stack bluffs at all, I'm just in a world of pain, and I want to make the world of pain less painful by keeping all the best hands in my range, certainly including aces, which is the very best hand I can have on this flop, given what my range is.
I think that there's a case at this depth for including like 5-4 suited and 6-5 suited and 7-6 suited, not 100% of the time, but occasionally in the squeezing range. In part because of spots like this. I don't think that changes the conclusion about checking full range, though. Yeah. And I think you make I think that's a very plausible strategy here. I'm not prepared to say it's definitely the best, but there's a good chance it's how I would play, and I would not be surprised if checking your full range or checking very frequently on this board is correct.
The turn is a deuce, so the board is 3-4-5 deuce, and we have the bad end of a straight. But I mean, really, does he have a six? Maybe we'll find out. Okay, so yes, deuce 3-4-5. We have aces. I've made a straight now, but it's a pretty obvious one. I decide to check again because it seems pretty hard to get called by worse, as I should have a fair number of aces in my range, especially from his perspective, once I check the flop. Villain thinks and bets 150. I call fairly quickly. I'm losing to only sixes and 5-6 suited or 6-7 suited, which I'm now not sure how often he even chooses to defend with or raise at all from under the gun plus one preflop. Having checked twice, I can also hope I induce a bluff at least some of the time. I induced a bluff at least some of the time. What do you think of that?
The thing that I like least is calling quickly. I think you risk... it's going to be somewhat obvious what you have anyway, but... I don't know. That just kind of jumped out at me as like you're just telling him exactly what you have when you call.
Really, you don't think it looks a little like kings? I think it looks a little like kings.
Huh, okay.
I mean, not entirely, but I would I would not call quickly. I think you're right to criticize that. I do think it looks a little stubborn sometimes, like it's a screw you call with kings or queens. But
so yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what Cyrus says here is correct. I think it's also it's worth thinking a little bit about what information we get from the villain's flop check. I think there are good reasons why the villain might want to bet 7-6 on the flop.
Yeah.
Because it's the nuts and we're pretty deep. And Cyrus has, I mean, as we said, like Cyrus very well might be checking his full range. And it's, you know, checking here is certainly a reasonable way to play aces and to play ace king. And there are a number of hands where it makes sense for Cyrus to check call here. So I don't think it's at all obvious that Cyrus is going to be like folding overly much after checking the flop. And when the villain has the nuts and there's a lot of money that he would like to put in the pot, there's good reasons why he should bet the flop.
Yeah, and I mean, you can't bet $1,000 later easily unless you bet something on the flop. And yeah, we're gonna want to be bluffing a lot. This is you gotta fire up the engine. I would not check the nuts ever on this flop, I don't think.
Yeah, so a good time for him to bet 7-6 suited. I think there's more of a case for the villain to check sixes or 5-6 suited on the flop. I think that if the villain got here with 8-6 suited, which does not seem too implausible to me, it's a bit of a stretch. I mean, it's a somewhat ambitious under the gun one open, but players like this, I would not at all be shocked to see it. I've certainly done it myself. So, and that also is a hand that I think is pretty likely to bet the flop, because with that hand, he's got a nut draw and he wants to be putting pressure on hands like aces and ace king. So I think that in terms of hands we're beating, I'm actually even not, that we're beaten by, I'm not too concerned about 7-6 suited. It's really just sixes and 5-6 suited are the ones that I think make the most sense. I also wouldn't expect, I would expect that if the villain had flopped a set, he would probably bet it or two pair, and then he would not bet the turn with those hands. So that's the good news, is that there's not that many hands out there that beat us, maybe even fewer than Cyrus is thinking. The bad news is that I don't think the villain has a lot of incentive to bluff here either.
Yeah.
There's really no draw that he could have except, I guess, 9-8 or some other, like, you know, ace-8 suited or something. So there's not a lot of ways that he can be betting with equity. And many people simply won't bluff when they don't have equity. Like, they'll semi-bluff, but they won't just make a random bluff for no reason. And as Cyrus points out, Cyrus has a lot of ace X in his range, which is obviously not check folding the turn. So what really matters here is, I think the villain has some good reasons to not bet an ace if he has one either, but there is some chance the villain is betting an ace now. Like, a lot of the reasons why Cyrus might check an ace also apply to the villain. But maybe the villain is betting an ace and Cyrus can chop with those. But for the most part, I think this is a pretty polarizing bet. And although it's true that not a lot of hands beat us, I also don't think there's a lot of bluffing going on here. It does hurt to not have sixes in our range. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, as I said, I do think there's a case for including a hand like 5-6 suited or 7-6 suited in the preflop squeezing range. Because there's so much value in showing up with a hand like that in this situation now. But you should jump in here.
Yeah. I like everything you said. I would change ace 8 to ace 7, which is just I think you made a small counting error, but other than that, right. Yeah.
Everything that I said needs to get shifted down one.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, Andrew just likes to play strip deck poker, but not strip by much. He just takes all the sevens out of the deck and the straights jump over. He says it's a good training tool. I don't really buy it, but that's what he does. I think everything you said is right. The thing I want to sort of put you know, neon lights around is that there are going to be a lot of aces that will check twice, and that's because there are a lot of aces in the three betting range to begin with, and sometimes we'll just blast away, you know, rightly or wrongly with hands that don't have an ace in them, and there's going to be a lot of the wrong end of a straight. I also want to say that the villain's bet size is pretty good. I think sometimes people default to a half pot, but here, since things are so much in our favor in the villain's shoes, betting 150 into 205, if anything, I'd bet a little bit bigger. And I want to salute the villain here for not autopiloting his way to like half pot bet after half pot bet, or just throwing 100 out there. I think going bigger is something you don't see in all 2-5 games, and is clearly the right play here. It's a great way to leverage the fact that your range beats somebody else's range by a lot, is to jack up the bet size. So good for him.
Yeah, and if he's doing this well, then he should be making the hero pretty indifferent between three different lines with ace-x. So whether the hero calls now, or calls now and folds the river, or calls now and calls the river, if the villain is betting in a balanced way, the expected value of all three of those lines should be pretty similar and pretty close to zero. Yep. So that's kind of the bad news here, is you've got a pure bluff catcher with no chance of improving. I guess the good news is it's not quite a pure bluff catcher, because the villain might be betting an ace, so yeah. I would be inclined not to fold the turn. And there are going to be some hands in my folding range. Like, if I had kings, I would be folding now. So I do think I have some non-ace-x in my folding range on the turn, but strap in, because the river is going to get ugly.
Yeah, and I do want to say there should be quite a lot of aces in the villain's range. He's going to be raising a lot of them under the gun plus one. He'll fold some of the easily dominated offsuit stuff, I think, to the three bet, but a lot of suited aces will be there. Possibly nearly every suited ace will be in his range, and that's a lot of combinations. So and some offsuit ones too. So we should expect, and I think a lot of them will get checked behind on the flop, and he has some reason to check some of them on the turn, but he'll certainly bet some of them on the turn too, I think. So we should expect villain to be villain's range to include at least a chunk of the same hand, the five high straight here. The river is a queen. And Cyrus says, I check again. Again, I can't be called by worse, and while it's unlikely, I can be beat sometimes. Villain bets 330. This is a very strange spot, and why I'm sending it to you. My hand is essentially face up as the second nuts. Technically third nuts, but I think 6-7 is pretty unlikely for reasons discussed above. So villain should almost never be bluffing, because he can't expect me to fold my hand. On the other hand, there are so few sixes in his range, and I never have a hand better than this here. There are pretty much no sixes in my range for three betting from the blinds into three players, including an early position raiser. So if I'm folding this hand, I'm essentially folding my whole range. Essentially, villain should know exactly what I have and play correctly against it. So he should have almost no bluffs, but also almost no value hands. So do you want to go first, or should I?
Yeah, I'll hop in. The last line here, he should know exactly what I have, is more or less true. I think that, you know, as I've said, I do think there's a case for, you know, in part, to make your hand a little less face up, while you might occasionally include a hand like 7-6 suited in your three betting range, but I've said that enough times. So even if the villain knows that you have an ace, and this is like kind of the heart of game theory, or at least one of the easier game applications of game theory to Hold'em, is it's not obvious what the correct play is. So you have an ace, but so he knows your hand, but he doesn't know what you're going to do with it. His assumption is that you're never going to fold the river, and if that's true, that he really does know that that you, Cyrus, are never going to fold the river, then yes, he should not bluff and he should bet his value hands. But of course, if he does that, if you know that he's doing that he's not bluffing and only betting value hands, then you should always fold the river. In which case, he in fact should bluff the river quite frequently. And anytime we find ourselves in this like back and forth, well, if I do that, then he should change his strategy drastically, but then if he does that, I should change my strategy drastically, in which case he should revert back to his original strategy. When we get into that back and forth, that's where a mixed strategy comes in. In other words, you're supposed to call sometimes, but not always, when you have an ace. If that's the only thing that you can have here, which I think is plausible, then there's really no, against an unknown opponent strategy, there's nothing better you can do than call sometimes and fold sometimes. And the same is true for him with bluffing. Of course, he can always bet with a six, and what he would like to do actually, and to some extent he took it easy on you by only betting 330, assuming that he gets here with enough bluffs, if he's in a spot where he knows what you have but doesn't know what you're going to do with it, the optimal strategy for him would actually be to go all in with all of his hands that can beat an ace, and also assuming he has enough bluffs to balance that. I even think there's a case as long as he's sufficiently confident that you're not ever going to show up with a six here, there's even a case for the villain to overbet with an ace, attempting to bluff you off of a chop. So if he was betting an ace on the turn, I think that this is such a good bluffing situation for him that he could even turn that ace into a bluff trying to get you off of a chop. So just as a theoretical point that I think is very important here and has applications in a lot of other situations in poker, just because the villain knows your hand does not mean that there's an obviously correct play for him. And in fact, like, this is, I just think, an interesting example of how game theory enters into a seemingly simple poker situation.
Yep, I agree. There may be some situations where he has so many value hands that he can capture the pot, in which case you can't call with anything. But yeah, in theory, if he's really sure you don't have any sixes, he should be moving all in with his sixes and his aces. So then enough bluffs.
In terms of what to do here, I do think that there are some reasons to believe that a lot of people won't expect you to fold an ace, at least not for $330, and that exploitively, you might be able to just fold all of your aces here.
Yeah.
That I would not at all be surprised if against a lot of 2-5 people, you can exploitively just not call with pure bluff catchers. I mean, I think in general, there are some exceptions and you tend to know them when you see them. But I think that in live poker, especially small stakes live poker, calling the river with a pure bluff catcher against an unknown or seemingly good player is not really a money-making play. Again, like, there are exceptions, and, you know, sometimes people are just, like, way over-aggressive, and usually it's not hard to recognize who those people are. But I tend to think, when in doubt, if I don't have any, by pure bluff catcher, I mean I don't have any blockers, I don't have any chance of beating a value bet. I think, you know, if anything, I'd rather err on the side of overfolding than overcalling.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's more true as the bet gets bigger. So this is a 66 big blind bet. And I that's bigger than a lot of people want to bluff at 2-5. The big problem is that he could have figured out that you don't have a six and be betting an ace here, trying to get value from kings or whatever. And that muddies the waters a little bit. But I also think you can find a fold here sometimes, because calling 330 to win 330 plus, or, you know, plus half of 505 is not a great play. So I think this is a fold here, at least sometimes. And but Cyrus gives us results. He says, I call, figuring that it can't be right to fold my best possible hand against a very narrow value range. He shows sixes. Thank you, and thank you so much for your awesome podcast. I owe so much of what I've learned about poker from you, Cyrus. Well, thank you very much, Cyrus. I appreciate the kind words about the show. As for it not being right to fold the best possible hand, that's often correct, but not always correct. And hopefully by now you have a sense of why this might be one of the situations where you can make a case for it. And
let me just flip this around. This is also your worst possible hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. And so we could just as easily say it can't be right to call with my worst possible hand against a narrow bluffing range.
Yep.
So bottom line, there isn't a right answer. It doesn't matter what you do, and life is meaningless. Thanks for writing into the show.
Have you been rewatching BoJack too? Yeah.
Time for one final strategy question?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry, did I cut you off from something?
No, I was just saying Cyrus did well to write to us, and thank you for writing to us. And if you have a hand you want us to talk about, or a question you want us to answer, or a comment, you should write to us at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. That is podcast@thinkingpoker.net.
Final strategy question coming to us from Mike, who happens to live just down the, well, not quite down the street, but not very far from where I grew up. Mike says, big fan of the show. I have listened to every episode. This was true in April of 2015 anyway, when he wrote to us. Sorry for the delay in getting your email, Mike. I've listened to every episode and love the fact that Andrew was podcasting down the street from me when he was in Catonsville. I live in Ellicott City. This hand deals with table image and whether or not to let someone who is tilting stack off, as opposed to protecting your hand. This is a Maryland Live 2-5 game, Saturday night around 7 o'clock, in case anyone finds that of strategic relevance. Opponent sits down and is a big talker, buys in for $400, the max is $500, and stacks off quickly. Rebuys $300 and stacks off again in three hands. Keeps going on and on about getting baptized as a new player at the table. Rebuys for $500, raises big two times in a row pre-flop, and shows 3-5 offsuit one of those times. So this is the player we're dealing with. Onto the hand. It is folded to me in the cutoff. I have $725 in front of me. I have a solid image, not that I expect this guy to know that in the limited time that he's been at the table. Tilted guy, he says re-raises to $100, so maybe someone else has opened.
Are you missing a line here?
So I have a solid image and have steadily increased my stack from 500 to 750. I raised to $25 with ace queen suited. The tilted guy re-raises to $100. And Mike says, I am tempted to re-raise. I take my time and eventually just call because I am in position and want to give him a chance to stack off to me on a good flop. I think that, you know, ace queen suited is not often a hand that I'm looking to stick in 100 big blinds with in a Maryland Live 2-5 game or a 2-5 live game in general. But I think it's pretty tempting here, given how this guy has been playing. I'm assuming that this player has $500 or less in his stack. If he's a lot deeper than that, I would probably change my opinion on this. So at this point, there's like $125 in the pot, and there's a very, very good chance that ace queen is the best hand. So I'm finding it pretty tempting to just ship it pre-flop, and if this guy wants to gamble pre-flop, you know, let him call and gamble with whatever he has. If he wants to fold and let me win $125 with no showdown when I have ace-queen, I'm also fine with that outcome. Do you see a strong case for calling it?
So being able to play the flop in position is pretty good, I think. I think the best case for calling is that a lot of players are going to be a lot looser about raising than about re-raising. And even some tilted players or people who are going on and on about getting baptized will choose to gamble by calling this raise instead of three betting. That said, since we made a larger than usual opening raise, the re-raise is to 100, jamming cannot be that bad, because if there's even some chance that he's getting goofy, then it's obviously the correct play by a lot. and if there's not, then it's like a slightly bad play, or maybe
ace queen suited plays pretty well against a strong ray. I mean, you're flipping with jacks, you're flipping with tens, you're blocking ace king and aces and queens. I mean, it's a pretty legit like semi bluff jamming hand, even if you can't really think of it as a value shove.
It's good. It's a good hand. There's nothing wrong with jamming. That said, I think calling is not that bad because we have position. Out of position, I would say that anything other than jamming is a very serious mistake. In position, I think jamming is the best play, but calling, you know, has other advantages and it might be close.
I'll say one other thing about calling is just that I might trust you, Nate, to call in position a little bit more than I would trust an amateur 2-5 player, because my concern is that Mike will give up with his hand too easily on flops that he doesn't get a big piece of.
Don't fold the deuce deuce three flop, by the way.
Or I mean, even like 10-7 deuce.
Yeah.
Spade. I think there's you have to recognize, if you are calling here and you're going to treat this as sort of a trapping hand, then you have to recognize, you know, you're like the assumption you're making is that this player has a overly wide preflop range, and so even a lot of flops that you don't improve your hand on are not that likely to improve him either. I mean, you also factor in the equity that you're likely to have with, for instance, two overcards and a backdoor flush draw. You need to be willing to play ace queen as at least a pretty decent bluff catcher on some flops that don't include an ace or a queen. And if you're not prepared to do that, I think you can make life easy on yourself and go all in preflop without giving up a lot.
Yeah, especially if you're going to go on tilt, if you put in, either if you fold and he shows you a bluff, or if you put in $400 more with unimproved ace high and you're losing to a pair, those are both frustrating things sometimes, and if that's going to affect your play down the road, then just stick it in. So the best standard play here is to stick it in. Calling does have some nice features, but if you put this hand in my hands right now and told me to do something, I would bet all my money with it. so there's that.
Mike tells us the flop is queen 7-4 with two diamonds, Mike holding ace queen with two spades. There's $200 in the pot and $400 remaining in the villain's stack. The villain bets the pot, $200. Mike says, again, I contemplate getting the rest in, but thought the villain would shove. He would have $200 behind into a $600 pot on any turn, regardless of his holding. So, I mean, if that assumption is literally true, that the villain is going to shove any turn no matter what, then I don't see... I think it's maybe impossible that shoving the flop could be better than just calling and calling the turn, given that assumption.
Yeah. Yeah, don't raise if that's true, right, or if that's even close to true.
The only thing that could happen is that villain could... So if we assume that villain always calls the shove on the flop, then there's literally no difference between the two lines. The only thing that could happen is that the villain could potentially fold to a shove on the flop, as opposed to putting that last 200 in. And I don't think there's any hand that he would fold on the flop that would want him to fold on the flop.
Right.
So yeah, I think if we're confident in that assumption that he really will shove any two cards on the turn, then I don't think there's any reason to shove the flop. And I think that that's probably close enough to true, combined with the fact that any hand that he chooses not to shove on the turn is probably also a hand that wouldn't call a flop shove anyway. And I really don't think we have to worry much about like free cards here. Obviously, we have an ace in our hand. If the villain has two diamonds, he's going to call the flop shove anyway. So we're not really, like, there's no sense in trying to like charge a draw or something. Really, the only potentially, the only spot where shoving could be better than calling is if villain has king X and is not going to put any more money into the pot unless he turns a king. That's like the only spot where we benefit from shoving, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Or if he has a gut shot and will somehow fold it to the flop and not bluff with it on the turn.
Yeah, like 8-6 or something.
But that's crazy. That's not what's happening here. I do want to say that I don't think it's true that he's going to bet all in on the turn no matter what. A lot of people play like this. Like, not a big portion of people, but play enough 2-5, no limit hold'em. You'll see a lot of this stuff. And it's not the case that all these people are betting all the time. Some of them are bluffing with their whole range. More likely, he's betting way too much on the turn, but not literally everything. It doesn't change the conclusion very much. But I do think, you know, at least some of these people will slow down with their Jack 3 suiteds or whatever that they get to the turn with, because they can figure out that you're probably not folding, and you know, they don't want to light $200 on fire. Yeah, it's a small point, but
that's actually kind of a pet peeve of mine, is, you know, people are very quick to throw around like any two cards, and yeah, you know, there's a big difference between like a wide range or a range that seems stupidly wide to me and any two cards. So people say that a lot, like, this guy plays any two cards pre-flop. Does he really? You've never seen him fold?
Yeah. So why didn't you just move all in with ace nine? Huh? Like, right. I call. The turn is a seven of hearts. He shoves 200. Oh, sorry, you're reading this one. I got excited. Sorry.
So the board is queen 7-7-4. Our hero holding ace queen. Villain shoves $200, and Mike snap calls. The river is a blank. Villain turns over jack seven for trips and takes down the 1K pot. Mike says, "I'm never folding the turn, getting 4-1. My question is about my preflop and/or flop play. Was it a mistake not to shove the flop? I'm guessing he's calling with middle pair anyway, but my reasoning was to let him stack off. He had five outs against me and got lucky to hit one. Should I have four bet preflop?" To make matters worse, he gathered his chips and went to another table two hands later, which, if you really believe that you have to get baptized at a new table, seems like a particularly expensive thing for the villain to do, but that's not
even right there.
So we've talked about whether you should... about whether you should have raised the preflop or the flop already. So I guess the last thing that I want to say here is just that we don't it's a, you don't want to like go back over a hand and say to yourself, could I have changed the outcome of this hand by doing something different? Then I guess I should have done that thing. So you don't want to look back at it and say, oh, you know, if I shoved the flop, he would have folded Jack seven and I wouldn't have lost this pot. Like we don't, you don't want him to fold Jack seven on the flop. So like shoving the flop in order to get him to fold Jack seven when you think he's going to stick it in on any turn card with Jack seven is not desirable to you. Basically there's, he has about a 10% chance of improving his hand on the turn. So 10% of the time you lose money as a result of letting him see the turn with, like assuming that he would have folded Jack seven on the flop, then 10% of the time you lose $200 when you let him see the turn. And 90% of the time you, or sorry, not 200, you lose 800 when you let him see the turn. And 90% of the time you win 200. So you, even there, that that comes out in your favor. You, like, given that expected value calculation, you would prefer to let him see the turn and just suck up the fact that 10% of the time you're going to lose the pot. I also think it's unlikely he would have folded on the flop, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, a little more than 10% because sometimes he gets there on the river. But yeah, but no, your point is right. And I can't resist. You said that, you know, if he thinks he has to get baptized at a new table, why is he switching tables? And there's a beautiful line from David Mamet's old essay on poker, The Thing Poker Teaches, The Things Poker Teaches. If the axiom you are acting under is not designed to make you money, you may discover that your real objective at the game is something else. You may be trying to prove yourself beloved of God. Yeah, so maybe this person is trying to prove himself beloved of God. But at any rate, Mike is appreciated by us, and thank you for writing in. Do you have anything else to say about that hand?
No, I don't think I do.
All right, good show.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening. And once again, if you would like to hear a strategy, hear, you know, your question discussed on the show, your hand discussed on the show, your comment discussed on the show, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Also, guest suggestions, very welcome. Podcast@thinkingpoker.net with your guest suggestions.
Todd tweeted back at me. He wants me to send him the book.
That you're going to send him, you're going to print out and send him a hard copy?
Yeah, I'll figure out a way to do it. I'm pretty excited about this. See you next week, everyone.
Take care. I know you want